our facilitator, Miss Marla Ray. Now she is seated. How are you this afternoon? We're going to continue the joint committee hearings that we began yesterday with the include the House Judiciary Committee, the Senate, and I think that Representative Max Williams is to my left today, and my good colleague Representative Patrick is to my left today, and Senator Menace, who could not be with us today, and I talked to him, is to my right, and we want to welcome you. I believe this is the first time that we've ever had this kind of a joint committee, recognizing that there are interrelationships between what happens in our public service, public safety system, and what happens in human services. But I'd also like to take the opportunity, I think, in this building, you've seen a lot of young people in the building today, and they are individuals who are among the academic achievers. They're mostly all gifted, talented, and gifted. They, most of them, I think, have come from the coastal communities, and seated in the audience is Brianna Webb, who is from Waterport. She is Jackie Winters today, and she promised me that she's going to pass out good legislation. She is in the seventh grade, and she is a 4.0 individuals out there. So I want you to know we do have some very, very bright students in the state, and she's also, her interest is in, her bill is about animal cruelty, which fits right into the correctional, some of the correctional issues, because we know when people are cruel to animals, they sometimes end up with later problems and enter in our system. So with that, I know we have, we're going to start on, what, number five.
Chair Winters, members of the respective committees, for your record, my name is Marla Ray. I continue to serve as your air traffic controller for the continuation of our presentation on the public safety system and the interrelationships. We'll pick up where we left off yesterday. At this point, I would like to introduce to you Scott Taylor. Scott is the Assistant Director for the Oregon Department of Corrections. He currently is responsible for the Programs Division. Previously, Scott was responsible for the Community Corrections Division. He serves on the Executive Board of the American Parole and Probation Association. He is a consultant with the National Institutes of Justice. My favorite part about Scott is he is the former mayor of the city of Canby. Scott is joined by Donna Middleton. Donna is the executive director for the State Commission on Children and Families. You'll see Donna around quite a bit this legislative session in actually all four of the committees before whom we're appearing today. Donna previously, before becoming director of the commission back in 1998, served at the county level, county human services staff and its programs, the whole realm, everything from mental health to public health, youth programs, chemical dependency, and the like. So at this point, Mr. Chair, Ms. Chair, Madam Chair, we'll turn this over to Scott and Donna.
Thank you very much, Chair Winters, Chair Patridge, and members of the committee. Again, my name is Donna Middleton, and Scott and I are going to present prevention and intervention. And we're going to start with our prevention intervention arrow. Scott calls it a whatever you call it.
A wedge.
A wedge, a funnel. But he's going to talk a little bit about this particular piece, and then at the end we're going to bring it back and talk a little bit more about it. So, Scott, you can start out with that piece.
Chair Winters and the rest of the Joint Committee, what I want to do is spend a moment on this because I think one of the reasons I am here is because of that past experience as a mayor and the Department of Corrections. So it kind of is a continuum of community at the end of, and I call this wedge a funnel. As we walk through the presentation, what I think is important that we want to keep emphasizing is we are a system, and we are. We start yesterday, you heard that we prosecute 37,000 felons in the court system. In a year, About 3,000 to 4,000 of those folks actually make it to the adult prison door. So that means we have a system that is moving people through, filtering out, sifting, doing some different things, and these people have the opportunity at any time to come back out into the community and in a prevention or intervention way stop further penetration or that back in. And the other piece of that funnel is that for the most part, as you move down into it, it gets more and more costly.
So we're that, conserving energy.
So that as you get down there, the cost of keeping a person in the adult criminal justice system as opposed to what you could have done while they were still back in school as a youth, something else, is a lot less expensive than where they end up with us. And that's a piece, as we talk about the total system working together, that I wanted to reemphasize. And we can have prevention and intervention happening at any time in the system. It's not just the one time at the very front end. We can, in fact, impact people and move them back up the funnel a little ways. And so with that, Donna.
Who are we? We are the Oregon Department of Human Services, which includes all of the services within the Human Services Departments. We are local community services that are provided on behalf of the Department of Human Services, which include counties, private nonprofits, Department of Human Services agencies that are located in the counties.
We are the county mental health and drug abuse prevention and treatment programs. These programs do both prevention and intervention at the local level, resulting in a reduced number of folks who penetrate deeper into the system. For example, the current cuts will result in about 3,600 families not receiving access to needed services that help divert children later on from the public safety intervention.
We are the private and nonprofit health services provided through the Oregon Health Plan, which includes hospitals, physicians, health maintenance organizations, mental health maintenance organizations, and all those services and supports. We are the state and local commissions on children and families, all 36 commissions in 36 counties that provide prevention services and supports, community planning. We support a comprehensive system of services in the areas of early childhood, healthy start, relief nurseries, parenting, juvenile crime prevention, mentoring, after-school programs, and family resource centers. We do this by leveraging community resources and engaging citizens.
We are local county juvenile crime prevention programs. There are a variety of those that we'll talk a little more in depth about. An example would be one that ran in Multnomah County, where juvenile probation and parole officers went out and worked with the schools for anybody that was truant, went and visited the homes, did family visitations, and a RAND study showed a tremendous drop in the kids that were then later on, or those kids being on corrections caseloads, penetrating deeper into the system.
We are child welfare programs. Child welfare is in the Department of Human Services and has offices located in most counties. Services include child protective services, foster care, adoption, community safety net. They also provide strength-based services and, when possible, include families when making decisions on the best interests of their children.
I wanted to go back for just a minute. We're also on the overhead. I'm sorry I lost that. We're the state and local corrections probation programs. As you heard yesterday, we supervise 18,000 juveniles and 45,000 adults. And we involve these high-service individuals in treatment, diversion, accountability, and efforts to intervene in both behavior patterns. And we are court-connected diversion programs, such as drug courts, where at last count we had 13 adult drug courts up in Oregon, a variety of juvenile interventions of a similar nature.
If I can interject at this point, you'll notice that we've done such a good job of worrying about everybody else in the process, Scott forgot about his very own program. So I just like
that will not go unnoticed.
We are community education programs like parenting, after school programs, child care, teen parents, and family resource centers.
What we do, We provide alcohol and drug abuse and mental health treatment services. All 36 counties provide some level of these responses. We know that by the time individuals reach the adult system, 77% have a serious alcohol or drug abuse problem, and 21% have a serious mental health problem. For those that we can reach before they penetrate that deeply into the system, we try and do that while they're on probation and prior to that time. The interaction at all levels of the criminal justice system with social service providers is extensive. An example here is we currently, within the Department of Corrections, have been working on a national model on transition back to the community. We've been working with the mental health population within the department, and we've identified the most severe mentally ill that are going to be released each month. We had been working with the Oregon Health Plan on a wraparound service in Multnomah County so that those folks coming out actually had the entire, as best we could put together, package. We met the other day with the Oregon Health Plan and found that those folks will no longer be covered when we release them and that intervention. So this is not only just about those in the public safety, but the other support networks that we rely on to provide the services upon release.
What are we? We provide community developed prevention programs. We have a community development program in which we plan together as communities to avoid duplication and gaps in services. We coordinate resources and we involve citizens. We are encouraging our communities to use best practices, and also communities identify what outcomes they want to achieve. Communities are able to invest in identified needs using juvenile crime prevention funds, local commission funds, alcohol and drug and mental health prevention, and state and federal funds. Communities are planning and providing early childhood services, juvenile crime prevention, alcohol and drug and mental health, and others. What research tells us is there is conclusive evidence that having multiple risk factors increases a youth's probability of committing a crime. At the same time, there are protective factors that appear to buffer the effects. There is now pervasive evidence that appropriate interventions can significantly reduce risks and associated rate of offending by high-risk youth. It is important to accurately identify high-risk youth and then use resources to provide proven and appropriate interventions matched to the youth's needs and learning styles. The U.S. Surgeon General Office estimates that parent training is one of the most comprehensive community-based approaches shown to be effective in reducing drug use and violence in teens. Community-developed programs are cost-effective interventions that reduce serious crime. For example, mentoring programs show a benefit-to-cost ratio of $5.29 per dollar spent. Intervene in family abuse situations. Family abuse situations, domestic violence, child abuse, elder abuse prevention, community safety nets, services to protect the disabled and the mentally ill, and respite care are some of those services. Research tells us that child abuse increases the likelihood of arrest as a juvenile by 53%, as an adult by 38%, for violent crime by 38%, and it increases the likelihood of arrest for females by 77%. Children entering child protective services and females living in poverty have a direct correlation with increased contact with both juvenile justice and adult correction.
As I mentioned earlier, we provide community corrections, probation, and diversion programs both at the adult and juvenile level. As was reported yesterday, we have roughly 18,000 juveniles on supervision in the community, 45,000 adults, and we manage a variety of intervention programs and diversion programs prior to official entry onto supervision.
Okay, juvenile crime prevention, alcohol and drug and mental health services, educational supports, detention alternatives, multisystemic therapy, wraparound services, juvenile department services, and family support for high-risk offenders. What we know, juvenile crime prevention programs and research tells us that the major characteristics of repeat offenders include 15 years or younger at the first offense, history of poor school attendance and performance, significant family problems, drug and alcohol abuse, history of pre-delinquent behavior, and delinquent peers.
To protect the public and prevent youth from entering criminal lifestyles as adults, we do this through a variety of school programs such as DARE, the SMART program to help youth learn to read. As a side note, we have 52% of the inmates entering the Oregon Department of Correction are functionally illiterate when they enter the Department of Corrections. We try to, so everyone that we can, in fact, improve those kind of skills reduces the amount. Research would tell us that's one of the prime factors in adult criminal behavior.
One moment, please, Scott. Senator Carter.
Scott, since you said you have 52% that are functionally illiterate, are there programs on the inside in terms of GEDs and all that kind of stuff for them to be going to school? And with us having the kind of crisis we're having in education today, has that been one of the drop-off points?
Chair Winters, Senator Carter, we currently address the population both by constitutional demand and educational demands that come in illiterate. They're put into the programs, and if we have the time, keeping in mind a large percentage come in that are English as a second language, and the length of time to move them up to literacy in English takes longer than some of the sentences we have to work with. So as we continue to do that, anybody who comes in at that level, we do a basic test at our intake center, and if they score on the basis of a 230 or below the eighth grade level, we put them in education as part of their program and try to provide that. What the cuts have done is reduce the number of beds or seats we would use for normal GED continuance of that kind of education.
Thank you. Scott, what percentage of the ESL is in that 52% category?
Senator Winters, I can have that for you in just a moment. I'm sorry, I'm trying to do some quick math here.
Well, you can get it to me later.
Thank you.
I mean, on my turn?
Yeah.
Mentally ill and addicted persons by providing treatment. We provide treatment methadone services, self-sufficiency, independent living skills, residential services and treatment, outpatient mental health and alcohol and drug, psychiatric services, acute care mental health services for youth and adults, and hospitalization. Children and families who receive community-based prevention and early intervention services. Those prevention-based services include mentors, relief nurseries, family centers, Head Start, early intervention, Healthy Start, after-school programs, parenting, child care, runaway and homeless services, community schools, and other services that affect the very young children in our state. Community-based prevention has some research behind that I'd like to mention. High-quality child care for school readiness programs have been shown to reduce future crime among participants by as much as 70%. Targeted early childhood intervention programs can generate the following: increased employment by participants, reduced welfare expenditures, reduced education and special education and health care costs, fewer arrests among the participants. More than 7 in 10 school-aged children and youth have their only parent or both parents in the workforce. After-school programs for youth reduce juvenile crime and substance use greatly among their participants. They also provide a number of other benefits, such as reduced teen pregnancies and reduced high school dropout rates.
Sources
of revenue: state and local income taxes, property taxes, beer and wine taxes, fees for services and other payments, federal funds and grants, juvenile crime and delinquency prevention grants, child care block grants, family support, private nonprofits and foundation dollars.
The cost drivers, demographic changes that we've talked about, the increase in population within Oregon and in specific areas, employment opportunities declining, education opportunities being limited, and the level of education directly affect the end result. The new improved street drugs, we're having stronger and stronger, more powerful drugs that, as we mentioned, 77% to 80% of the people who come into the institutions at the adult, and I believe juvenile would be similar, have already a serious alcohol or drug problem. Federal and state mandates, as we receive mandates for certain types of programming and services that need to be performed, and the inability to move certain populations in a management style, all drive our costs. Community and family instability. We've been doing some work recently on the mapping of individuals that come from certain communities and return to those communities, and the instability and the damage done by that large volume in specific areas affects the overall cost and the ability to deliver change to that. And we do know, as Donna was speaking of the juvenile, we know from a variety of evidence-based research that is now becoming more and more supported, that we have areas that affect the entry into criminal behavior, things such as attitude, associates, employment and educational skills, substance abuse, community functioning. Those are all elements that are manageable, that are impact, that we can impact, and wherever we don't do that, we see those costs either going up or down. And the areas of discretion. How to respond for calls for help. As we talk about an entire system, you can imagine all the different opportunities, all the way from the beginning teacher, preschool, all the way up to the probation officer. They all have the ability to decide how fast to respond and what depth to respond. And as we each move through the budget opportunities, we begin to prioritize. And when we prioritize, that means that someone else then gets a portion of the population that may have been dealt with previously by someone else. And those shifts move it up and down. The promptness of response. So areas of discretion, who will you respond to and at what speed, depending on which part of the system you're in, and what are the costs of doing that or not doing that. And the choice of no response. Are there certain events that you will no longer respond to that you used to respond to, trying to intervene or prevent, you no longer do that, you make decisions about that. And then who responds? Is it best for mental health personnel to respond, law enforcement agencies, children's services, mentors? Who is the best person, best organization to intervene? Each of those take with them a different cost and a selectivity.
Allow children, youth, and adults to default into the criminal justice system. We could provide very few or no interventions and prevention services. We could allow the behavior to accelerate to the point that the police are called, jails are full, institutions continue to be built, and courts are overwhelmed. Whether to charge with a crime or divert to other community treatment. In order to make that decision, you have to have services and supports to divert to. Courts will have no choice. They'll either charge or release back to community only to have the person come back into the court system again and again. Just as they're not ready for prime time players demonstrated yesterday, the person will keep coming back over and over again. We can do this by ignoring what works and the risk factors we know to be associated with criminal behavior.
Senator Carter, tell me under what circumstances, or if you could for me, describe a situation where you let a kid default into the system.
Senator Carter, there was a recent article in the Salem paper where a mother was talking about the fact that she could not get her young son into the mental health and system, and he was having behavior problems. She was calling around. She could not find the services. Their recommendation to her was to allow him to violate the law, get into the criminal justice system so he could get services.
Wow.
I just wanted to end this piece by just talking a little bit about the profile of what the young people look like in Oregon OYA's custody today. 79% of them are deficient in school credits. 64% are involved in special education. 55 have been diagnosed with mental health disorders. And 46 have a parent who's been convicted of a crime.
Before we conclude today, we'll have, and this is, I think, responsive in part to Senator Carter's look of astonishment, as well as questions raised by Representative Butler and Representative Crummell yesterday. Before today is over, we'll provide the cost comparisons that you were looking for, as well as the skit that the Not Ready for Primetime players put on yesterday. Representative Butler asked for what would that have cost the system for Chris, the defendant, to have touched each player in that process. So before we conclude today, we'll run through those very quickly.
Just one thing in quote. Senator Gordley asked last time what would be irrational, as I remember. And I'd like to add just a couple of comments in that area.
Irrational.
Irrational. Yes, irrational.
Thank you.
For Oregon to become a crisis-only state, to ignore what research tells us, to abandon prevention efforts and continue to build it, because they will come. I'd like to end with this quote. We'll win the war against crime when we're as ready to guarantee a kid in a place in an after-school program as we are to guarantee a felon room and board in a prison cell. Thank you very much.
Donna, since you mentioned other states, how do we compare with other states?
Senator Winters, we don't compare very favorably. As a matter of fact, I should have brought the map, but the Kids Count report shows that Oregon has 25% or more of our families with high numbers of risk factors. We're actually one of the bottom three states in the nation.
Wow.
Marla. At this time, Chair Winters and members, we'd like to move into four case studies for you. Each of these will be brief, and then we'll move into some list of options and then respond to some of your additional questions. Our first case study this afternoon, and I think we can, unless you like the ambiance, I think we can kind of crank up the lights just a little bit so you can see who's...
Well, I think we can, although the ambiance is nice. We can crank it up just a little bit so that you can see.
I'm worried, Madam Chair, we're losing Senator Morris.
Well, in that case, crank up the lights.
We'll have to make him sit in front of
you. Yeah. I'd like to ask Bob Nickel to join me. Bob is the manager of community services for the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services within the Department of Human Services. Bob has been with the state for 12 years. Prior to that, was in county programs and county services for the decade prior. So, Bob Nickel.
Thank you again. For the record, my name is Bob Nickel, and I was asked to provide you with what's described as a case study of methadone. Now, what I'm not going to do is walk you through an individual person. I'm going to describe more at the state level, the systems level, kinds of things that we anticipate happening here very soon. In fact, people at this point are being titrated off methadone around the state. A couple of programs are likely to close. The removal of chemical dependency benefits for the Oregon Health Plan standard population will result in the loss of state funding for 3,302 clients in methadone programs. These clients are on methadone as a treatment substitute for heroin or other opiate addiction. The average cost per year for methadone treatment per person is about $3,000. It's a little bit more in some county-operated programs, a little bit less probably in some that aren't provided with county employees. But that's a fairly good rough figure. The average duration of treatment, I'm told, is about, for a successful treatment, is about 1 year. I think one study here in Oregon showed 406 days. So roughly, people are generally, if they're successful in being on it, most people are successful, need to be on it for a period of about a year, maybe sometimes a little longer. There are people, I understand, people are on methadone maintenance programs for much longer. And I think we have to be aware that people have very individual kinds of characteristics, and you see those kinds of variations in other kinds of mental health and alcohol and drug treatment.
Bob, just because you said the average, and I'm assuming that statistical data is coming in from the counties into you or someplace where it's being averaged out. because the letters I've been receiving is anywhere from 4 years, some 5 years, and some even 10 years.
Senator Winters, I don't think it's unusual for people to be on for 4 or 5 years. And I think you have to look at, you know, what kind of statistical average you're talking about. But the study that I just looked at from our own CPMS data was 406 days. I should add that that figure may be influenced somewhat by the fact that those are people who are closed out of services. And so people who remain in services longer may not be showing up in those same kind of data points. So I'm quite aware, too, that people sometimes are on frequently for 4 or 5 years. In Oregon, let me back up a little bit. Methadone treatment is one of four well-established evidence-based practices in the alcohol and drug treatment field. I'd like to make a distinction between best practices and evidence-based practices. The two terms get used, and I think sometimes interchangeably, and I think we need to draw a clearer distinction. Best practices can be what a group of people in a certain trade have gotten together and decided as a group makes sense, and maybe the common practice. But I can tell you that at one point, lobotomies were probably considered a best practice. And I think that in this day and age, we need to think about what a body of evidence, in many cases now for 20 or 30 years, tell us is truly science or evidence-based practices. So when I say that methadone treatment is one of four well-established evidence-based practices, that's setting a fairly high standard. The others, just if you're curious, are 12-step groups or 12-step facilitation, AA-type projects, cognitive behavioral counseling, and motivational counseling. And that's not to say there aren't other kinds of effective treatments, but those are very well established now through many, many years of scientific studies.
Where does Bob acupuncture fit in this?
Senator Winters, I'm not aware of whether there's an extensive body of scientific research on acupuncture. Not to say it isn't effective, but I don't think that it's risen to the level of the standard that would be getting these well-established evidence-based practices. I think we have to think about and be open to things that are probably called promising practices as well. And the idea there is to make sure that there's some study that's going on that's not just anecdotal. And I would hope that acupuncture, because I've seen some studies on acupuncture, appears to be a promising practice, but I think we need more study.
Representative Fancy.
Thank you, Chair. Would it be safe to say that maybe one of those four might work better for one individual where another one may work better for another?
Chair Winters, Representative Przanski. Yes, I think, for example, methadone maintenance is not an evidence-based practice for people who have an alcohol problem, for example. So when I talk about this, you have to ask also what is the population for whom that's the appropriate treatment. Thank you. All right, in Oregon, there are 5,034 persons on methadone, according to the latest enrollment information. And as I mentioned before, of these, 3,302 were people who had their methadone treatment paid for through the Oregon Health Plan standard. Research indicates that 80 to 90% of methadone clients start using heroin again. In other words, they relapse if they're terminated from services before they've completed treatment. I used the lower end of that scale because the last thing in the world I think we need to do right now is overestimate or exaggerate things. So if 80% of the 3,302 people who are being cut off from the Oregon Health Plan standard benefit relapse, there will be 2,640 heroin addicts resuming their habits in Oregon very soon. The typical heroin or other opiate addict must produce $200 in cash each day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, in order to maintain their addiction on the streets. And at this conservative rate, if you get your calculator out, you'll see the $200 adds up over the next 365 days to $193 million in property crimes that will need to be committed in just the next year. It's an astounding figure. And I, again, not to exaggerate, a $200 television set, if they steal it from your or my house, is not worth $200 on the street. What I hear is everything is worth $20 on the street. So if they steal my $500 stereo, they're going to probably get $20 or $30 for it. So I think this estimate of $193 million, although it blows my mind in many ways, I think is something that we have to look at and take somewhat seriously. If you're a man and you're addicted to heroin, you'll probably be able to commit property crimes in that general vicinity. And that means cars, videos, DVD players, television, stereos, jewelry, etc. will be targeted first. And personal crimes of assault will also get added into the mix at the point when there's an interruption of a burglary or some such event. If you're a woman, and I'm not recommending this, you can also do all of those above, or you can enter prostitution. You can sell your body in order to come up with the $200 in cash. So there will be a considerable increase, we think, in sexually transmitted diseases, which, as you know, is already a major problem in this state and most states. And that's not to mention the other social costs that are involved. And we also need to be aware that 90% of addicts coming into our methadone treatment programs are hepatitis C positive. So, again, we expect a resurgence in those kinds of health issues. We also expect to see an increase, frankly, in heroin-related overdoses and deaths. And our office is working now to see if we can get an automated kind of assessment of death records so that we can tie people who are enrolled in or had been enrolled in methadone programs to their causes of death over the next couple of months. And I'm sure the legislature will be interested in knowing what kind of data we can come up with there. And finally, I'd just like to point out that there are many children whose lives are going to be drastically harmed by the cutoff of methadone treatment, because many of the people who are in these programs are people that you would not pick out as heroin addicts on the streets. Many of these are family people. I'm trying to get an estimate of the actual number of children who are living with parents who are on the methadone program, and I haven't been able to come up with that yet, but I think that's an important number to get to, and we'll keep working to get that. But these children, as you've heard before with the previous presentation, are also at great risk.
Excuse me, Senator George has a question.
Bob, do we allow them to buy back into the methadone treatment? Because, you know, if a person was on methadone and they were looking at $200 a day for heroin, you can buy back into the program for less than $10. Do we offer that option to someone who maybe has been cut?
Senator Chair Winters, Senator George, I'm told that the actual figure is probably more like $50 a day to get back into the program. They will have those options. Many of these people, though, are going to struggle to come up with that kind of cash on a regular basis. And I would grant you that some of the people may be able to buy back in, and we're certainly going to try to offer those kind of opportunities.
Can you provide me with the information? I understand that the manufacturing cost is 7 cents, and the dosage cost is $5. So can you give me some information from the cost of manufacturing to the cost of when it's dispensed from our clinics, actually, so we can have a better, because from 7 cents to $50 seems to be awfully
Chair Winters will be happy to do that. I also want to point out that successful treatment is fairly uncommon when all you do is dose the person. And so there are some other costs in successful treatment other than just the cost of the medication, but we'll get those numbers for you.
Madam Chair, can I have a follow-up on that?
Senator George.
Well, you gave us the figure that it was $3,000 a year, so it's going to be under $10 a day. So we're going to, if a person decides to buy back, we're going to add on what administrative costs, because are we reducing those as we reduce the client list?
Chair Winters, Senator George, I will check on that to see. I'm told that the cost of programs varies somewhat between $3,000 and upper ends. I was just talking with Jeff Davis from Marion County, and his costs are considerably higher than that. And we'll check on some of those figures and get those for you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Chair Winters, if we can move on, I'd like at this point to bring up two individuals at the same time. Nancy Miller from the Office of State Court Administrators, from the State Court Administrator's Office. Nancy's the Director of Court Programs and Services Division. She's worked in the judicial branch for the last 15 years. In Nancy's current capacity, she's also Director for the Oregon Citizen Review Board. Joining us, the very honorable Pamela Abernethy, Marion County Circuit Court Judge. Pamela began her legal career clerking in the Oregon Supreme Court For the next 12 years, she worked with some absolutely pleasant, wonderful, charming people in the Department of Justice. Would be me. Pamela was a trial litigator in complex litigation. She has been a trial court judge since 1993, appointed to what was then the district court. We've now combined those district circuit. Since November of 2001, Judge Abernathy has been assigned full-time to the juvenile court here in Marion County. Hears dependency and delinquency cases exclusively and oversees the county's juvenile drug court. Judge Abernathy and Nancy are going to take a family and walk that family through and us at the same time through the system.
Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Winters, Chair Patridge, Chair Williams, members of the committee, thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to come and speak with you about these important issues. I learned at a training once that you should never do anything important between 1 p.m. and 3 p.m. in the afternoon, and your attention span is laudable. Judge Abernathy and I would like to take you through a family as it moves through our court system and our treatment systems. And basically what we're going to do this afternoon, hopefully very briefly, is show you what that family would have looked like in July of 2001, and then show you what that family will look like in March of 2003. Judge?
Thank you very much, chairs all, and representatives and senators. Actually, first, I would like to go off text and just respond to Representative Krummel's question of yesterday, if I may, if you still have it. I believe I was touted as the one who could answer it, so I will. The question was that guy found in violation of his probation for not completing treatment that was not available to him? The answer is no. He was found in violation of his probation because he absconded from supervision. Now, there's a causal relationship between the fact that he failed and the fact that no treatment was provided for him, but technically that's why he was found in violation of his probation. All right. We want to introduce you to John Mary Crystal. And
yes,
I'm sorry.
Representative Williams.
Your Honor, it might be helpful if you would actually connect the dots for us on the causal relationship.
Certainly.
I just think that would be a useful thing for everyone to hear.
Certainly. If you recall, the judge ordered him into a community-based program and put him on supervised probation, least costly alternative rather than putting him in jail or prison. The hallmark of effective treatment, as I think the previous guest who talked about prevention continuum illustrated, is effective probation is tied to effective treatment. So we order the guy to go to mental health treatment and alcohol and drug treatment because he has probably a co-occurring disorder. That is, he has both an Axis I mental health problem and he is a substance abuser. Okay? Now, the only way he can survive on probation is if he gets that kind of treatment. And without that treatment, he's going to fail on probation, and that's what happened. So we order him to go to treatment, but we say, well, we can't treat you because Oregon Health Plan doesn't have any money anymore. Now, technically, he could come up with his own money for that treatment, but we know that's not going to happen, so he fails. And that's kind of where we are. So we're not actually punishing him for the failure of treatment, we're punishing him for the absconsion from supervision that happens because he isn't treated. Okay, back to my family, if
one
I could.
One more comment.
Yes.
One more comment before the judge introduces you to the family, because I think it's important for you to know. We worked closely with the Oregon Youth Authority, DHS, and the Marion County Juvenile Department in putting this scenario together, and every single colleague that we worked with said, do not gild the lily. Do not make up a family that's going to look so outrageous that the committee is not going to believe that this actually happens. What we are showing you here is truly a typical family that we see. And when Judge Abernathy and I were preparing for our little talk, she said to me, you know, this family's way too intact. So we actually went the other way.
All right, John, Mary, Jason, and Crystal, you are now an officer on the Salem Police Department. You get a call and you enter their home. And as you open the door, and actually I drew these facts from true cases. I'm not allowed to speak of pending cases but I've changed some facts. But every one of these facts about the condition of this house is true, and it really isn't even the worst. You open the door, there's a stench of urine and feces, and really, I hope I'm not shocking you, but this is how it is out there. There are five stacks of garbage in the living room. There is an overwhelming ashtray full of cigarette butts. There is the boy, Jason, age two, running around naked. Mom says he doesn't like to wear clothes. as the officer, continue in the home, you find evidence of methamphetamine. That is, you find methamphetamine. You find the pipe. As you enter the child's room, there's actual human feces on the floor of the child's room and on the bed. When examining the child, you see that the child is actually injured. And upon inquiry, the wife admits that there has been domestic violence and a plate inadvertently has hit the child. So what happens next is what we're going to tell you as we continue the story. The other, well, you know a little bit about John and Mary from, I guess, the garbage left in their home, and a little bit about the son. The other player in this little drama is 14-year-old Crystal, and she's grown up, of course, with these parents. And it wouldn't surprise you to know that she's already on probation in Marin County Juvenile Court for stealing a car. That's a Class C felony, UUMV. So she is what you would call a juvenile delinquent. So let me tell you what happens briefly to the adults. And Nancy's going to talk about what happens to the kids. Mom is arrested for the drugs, also arrested for a child endangerment. Those are decisions made by the DA. And Mom and all her cases are assigned to one judge. Dad is jailed because of the domestic violence. He's charged with all the things Mom is, plus felony assault, because in Oregon, as thanks to you, if a child is present, it's a felony, not a misdemeanor, for what would be just an assault for. There's actual room in the jail, so Dad stays put.
Because it's July of last year.
I'm sorry. Oh, I missed the whole darn thing. Okay, it's July 2001. And here's what's happening to our family. All right. So Dad is assigned to the same judge as Mom, and we approach imminently the plea date for them. Meanwhile, over in Kidland, Nancy?
Meanwhile, over in Kidland, when you pick the parents up, you ask them if there were any other relatives in the area. There were not. So both of the children were placed in DHS emergency foster care. There was a hearing the next day. That hearing was before the same judge that is hearing the mom's case and the dad's case. While this is going on, DHS is immediately starting to do assessments on the family to determine what kind of services are needed. They are involved with the Marion County Juvenile Department because Crystal's on probation, and everybody is working together, scheduling family meetings. We've got a coordinator in the court who's pulling all the agencies together to get one plan for this family. So the assessments and the beginning of service delivery are happening at that point.
The plan for the family is coordinated by the judge who's seen all these cases. The adult criminal, all three flavors of crime. The juvenile delinquency for the daughter. The dependency cases involving the children. And the judge orders a coordinated, integrated kind of package, which includes mental health and alcohol treatment for Mom, who's found to have post-traumatic stress disorder. That's a diagnosable mental illness, and depression stemming from sex abuse and domestic violence, early sex abuse as a child and domestic violence from this partner. Dad is found to be in need of domestic violence offender treatment along with drug and alcohol treatment. The teenager is put into a juvenile delinquency drug court where the teenager comes to see me every week and is supported through a strength-based approach and given positive reinforcement for good choices and consequences for bad. The children are kept together in the same placement and but are moved home within about 2 or 3 months because mother is able to make astoundingly good progress with the integrated treatment that she is receiving. Mother has some economic problems, however, but the agency comes up with some flex funds to help her from becoming homeless, so the children are able to return home. The teenager is eventually successful and a graduate of the juvenile drug court. The two-year-old is aided by a couple of things. Mom, once she gets clean and sober, gets some in-home skills training through DHS, parenting skills, housekeeping skills, etc. Mental health treatment she's getting aids her with both the depression. She gets counseling for the PTSD. And as the case moves ahead and the agency is looking towards termination down the road, Mom is referred to the Salem Relief Nursery where she can continue to be involved and get assistance from that. That, as I'm sure Senator Winters is aware and many of the rest of you, that's funded about 60%, or it was until the measure failed through state dollars. But it is a public-private partnership. One of the key...
Your Honor.
Yes.
Maybe I take this opportunity for members on this panel, legislators both from the House and the Senate. On the 12th of this month, there will be a reception at what we call Building Blocks here in Salem, and you're all invited so that you can have a first-hand view of what happens at a relief nursery, just so that, you know, I would encourage all of you to attend. Now, did I take my cue well?
That was absolutely perfect, Senator Winters, and there are many inspiring stories that come out of that. I know this is quite a depressing 2 days for you. If you want to get inspired, come on down, because you'll probably need it. And if you need wine too, we're going to have that for you as well. All right, that is really the good news about this family. It's reintegrated. There's some in-home services, skills training for Mom, mental health, drug and alcohol. Dad makes it through his DV offender treatment. He's actually able to make some good progress there, and he is in fact reintegrated into the home as well. So we've got an intact family back and a mother and father who are now ready to be able to provide not only safe sanitary home but some more appropriate structure and supervision for these kids. That was July 2001. Bum da dum bum. Now we're going to tell you the story of March 2003. Nancy?
And I'll try to yell into the microphone, but just to visually show you what we already know may be some of the consequences, since so many of the public safety agencies have already gone through their planning. In all likelihood, you will lose your one family, one judge, your alcohol and drug treatment, your flex funds, and the return of the children. Again, you'll lose your one family, your drug treatment, and your flex funds. There will be no hearing Friday. The courts are closed. These kids will be in care until Monday before they have a hearing. There will be no probation violation hearing on Crystal. There is no attorney to represent her. So you end that outcome, and over here, after the parents leave, the visits are over. He cannot go home.
Nancy, you may want to explain what flex funds are.
So that I can talk into the microphone. Flex funds are funds through the system of care provided by DHS that assist families obtaining the kind of services that are outside of the normal array of services. In this example, for example, you would see flex funds used to help the family pay emergency rent to keep them in their house. You would see flex funds used to buy a bus pass for the father so that he could get to his job. Those kinds of things that are outside of what you would normally see, parent training, drug and alcohol, those things.
So very quickly, and I know I can be picked up if I speak this loud, I'm going to talk about the differences now in March 2003 for mother and daughter. We've got four judges hearing these variety of cases, not one. As Nancy said, there's no treatment available. DHS tries to offer mother treatment consistent with what's needed in the dependency case. DHS is required to make reasonable efforts to fix the parent so the child can come home. However, if a parent is still substance abusing, there's no way they can take in that education. So we're going to see that there's a question about whether reasonable efforts were provided where they were all predicated on alcohol and drug treatment that didn't happen because there's no OHP money for it. Mom, again, goes untreated. She's homeless. She loses contact with DHS because she's still out using. Meth is more important to her than either her 2-year-old or her 14-year-old. And she absconds, just like our defendant yesterday, from supervision, whereabouts unknown, warrant issued, and she'll be picked up on a probation violation. And because she has felonies, she will be incarcerated. Daughter, I get the girls. The difference is here. She's placed in emergency foster care. DHS doesn't have homes for a 14-year-old. She's in one place. Actually, I'm not sure where she is. I bet she's in our detention center, Mr. Oglesby, because there's no other place for her. And that happens a lot, and you don't want me to go off text, so I won't. But you can ask me about that later. Let's see. Other differences. There's no drug court because the courts are closed 4 days a week, and I got to put 4 days, what was 5 days into four, so I don't have time to run a drug court. So she's not getting that weekly supervision, that integrated treatment from a team, the embracing of a whole bunch of adults that think she hung the moon and give her encouragement every week. And so she is not making the kind of progress that she would in our drug court. She's picked up for marijuana. That's a probation violation. She wants a hearing because she's a teenager, and even though the evidence is on her, she says, I got to have a hearing. You're thinking, what for? But anyway, there's no lawyer to be appointed for a hearing. And in fact, that hearing is set out as per the Chief Justice's protocol for July. So there's no immediate consequence for the PV. She's released home. Of course, there is no home. Actually, she can't be released home yet. Where the heck is she going?
She's just released,
she's
Judge.
She's released somewhere. Well, that's not working. Anyway, you're getting the gist.
There was a home. They became homeless right after she was released.
Okay. But Mom hadn't made any progress, so she wasn't going back home. She was actually released from our detention center to something. We don't know what. I know. She couldn't be released home, so we committed her to the custody of the Oregon Youth Authority. And they thought she needed secure residential treatment, but there wasn't a bed for her at Hillcrest. And so she was released back to an OIA Proctor home. She ran from that. And where she went was Portland. And she did what many, many, many teenage girls do. Really, they harm themselves more than they are criminals. She turned to prostitution, and she got into meth. And she is now HIV positive. She's pregnant. And she's living on the streets in Portland. And, you know, this is not outlandish at all. So the last point I want to make about mother and daughter is that this baby that daughter's going to give birth to is going to be born drug affected. We might not pick up the fact that that mother was a juvenile delinquent and there's a warrant and all that. We might not pick that up. I mean, she might leave the state and come back or whatever. And so chances are, we might get a hold of or have this child come to our attention when he's like 2 years old. And if you know anything about brain development, you'll know that if he's been living for 2 years with his drug-addicted mother, then he may already be cognitively damaged. And we have a lot of 2-year-olds who are adopted out, and then they fail adoptions because the damage done in the first 2 years of life is astounding because the brain's growing from the 40% it is at birth to 80% at age 24 months. So that's just a comment on the intergenerational, the multi-generational problem. And so if we continue to cut prevention, not only do we fail this generation, but then it's two or three generations before we can sort of make back what we're losing. So that's mother and daughter, and quickly father and son.
Just very quickly, you can see, and you have the handout in front of you, without the services, we also lose contact with the father. His whereabouts are then unknown. What that then means for the two-year-old child now under the new federal and state guidelines is that there's no choice but to file a petition to terminate the parent's rights. The kicker on that one, though, is it's really questionable whether the state could prevail in a termination case in this situation because of the lack of services up front. So unclear what happens to the two-year-old. We just know he's now drifting in the foster care system.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Your Honor, for the case that occurred back in that time when we could provide all of those services, has your experience been that when you have that kind of a coordinated action to assist the family, that it's you are presenting like a one-time intervention over a period of time. Wouldn't it be more common that there would be multiple interventions over a period of time? The family would not suddenly become functional after 6 months of intervention.
Chairs all and Senator Devlin, I did shorten it up a little bit. Realistically, well, first, the easy answer to your question is, yes, we can make that family whole and functional as long as they're clean and sober and they get some skills training. Now, how long that takes depends on the family. We wouldn't close that case in 6 months. You're absolutely right. We keep doing home visits. When I say we, I mean, of course, DHS, but we would keep monitoring them. I think the key to their long-term success is that they get connected with non-governmental kind of community supports, like the relief nursery, like some efforts we have in Salem and the Highland Grant neighborhoods. But one of the cases this is based on, that family already had a couple of voluntary agreements with DHS and failed. This law enforcement removal represented really a breaking point or rock bottom for the family, and I have to assume in my hypothetical that they were ready to change. And the key is, of course, the substance abuse treatment for everybody, but the mental health treatment for mom is also a key. And once you have those things in place, some skills training in terms of parenting and a little help on the economic side so they don't lose housing and so forth, you'd be amazed at the turnaround. It really does work. If it didn't work, I would have to not be doing this job. But this chart you have that I think Donna Middleton and showed you, you know, all those things in these columns, it's not wasted money. It actually really does work. I hope I answered your question. But it would be, I'd keep an eye on that. I wouldn't dismiss wardship on those kids, especially since there'd been a couple of voluntaries that had failed, probably for at least a year. And so I'd be having review hearings. Citizens Review Board would be, well, actually, they'd be back home. But we'd be keeping an eye on the family. But I think they could succeed. Absolutely.
Representative Bates.
Madam Chair, one of the things that always concerned me about this is I've watched these families as you have and probably followed them literally more than you have because I'm a family physician for 25 years. I've seen three generations now. The damage done to children who are families being watched the first 4 years of life is so devastating, and I've watched those kids come up through those first 3 or 4 years, and then as they become adults have the same problems their parents and grandparents did. The only concern I have in the programs we're running with each, because I'm supportive of those programs, is I've always been concerned about the length of time and how careful we are to end parental rights. And I've always wondered if we shouldn't be stepping in sooner and saying, I'm sorry, we can't carry on this way. Your child, that's a short window of time here. The damage is so intense those first 4 years that you've done things that no normal family would do. It's not three, four, five, six strikes, you're out. It's one strike, and you're out of there. and you take those kids out of family and give them someplace safe so we can actually end this cycle. I'd like to have your comments on that, if you would.
Certainly, Chair Zoll, Representative Bates, I'm so glad you brought up that comment again about the damage done to a child's brain in the first 3 or 4 years of life. If we could all live and breathe that every day and make decisions based on that, we would be so much better along. With respect to your question, there are constitutional reasons why we can't move more quickly, and those parents are constitutionally owed due process that you as a physician would like to see not owed, but nonetheless it's there. There is a practical answer, though, and the practical answer is really, since the Adoption Safe Families Act, federal and state law requires that the agency have a concurrent plan, meaning the backup plan. And what many of us try to do with a very young child, let's say this boy was 3 months, what many of us judges try to do is say, all right, where's the concurrent plan? And in the best of circumstances, you find a relative and you say to the relative, look, plan A is that we rehabilitate this family. But if it doesn't work, plan B is that you're it for all time. Now, there are many hoops we have to go through until that happens, but can you take this baby now so that you don't have a variety of care providers, you've got one consistent, and you know that will help in terms of preventing reactive attachment disorder and all of the other problems that attend. So you try to get that baby somewhere and somewhere secure so there's not going to be movement, and then if you do have to get to that termination, you haven't changed anything from the child's perspective. If you don't have a relative available, obviously it's a little harder to do because you can't say, you know, this child's free when there's a lot of legal due process owed the parents.
Just very quickly, Chairs and Representative Bates, in all the years that I've been in the court system, I have seen the most substantive changes in the last 3 years. Since the implementation of what was Senate Bill 408 in the 99th session, which was our state's bill to implement the Adoption and Safe Families Act that the judge talked about. I've been in thousands and thousands of reviews of cases, and I agree with you that for a very long time it was chance after chance after chance. Our experience now is that parents are told up front, you have 1 year. Now, 1 year is still a long time, but that's the due process piece. But it was a lot longer than 1 year before.
Chair Winters, if we can move now, thank you both. If we can move now into our final case study, I'd like to invite up Jeff Davis. Jeff is the Marion County Mental Health Director, position he's held since 1984. Prior to that, Representative Przanski and others, Jeff served as the Mental Health Director in Lane County, position from 1976 to 1985.
Chair Winters, Chair Partridge, committee members, thank you for this opportunity to share with you. Two things I would like to do. One is to walk you through a situation of a person, adult, in the criminal justice system, and then actually talk a little bit about what are some things you might consider thinking about. You've got a tough decision ahead of you. We need to look where we can go and what we can do. And in addition to giving you the case study, my idea is to share with you some of my thoughts about things you might consider as you deliberate further on this. The case study has to do with the police being called to an individual's home. The woman's name is Judy. She's got a boyfriend there, and she has attempted to stab her boyfriend with the steak knife that she got in the kitchen. This situation could be more complicated if there were children in the home, but in this particular case, there isn't, and I think you've heard quite a bit from the judge already about those situations. She's sitting in the chair when the police arrive. She's very shaken. Then they try to contain her. She pushes them away, frantically shouting and screaming and yelling, talking about people are out to get her. They're going to take me away. She points to the fact that the windows have cardboard over them and the fact that she's trying to protect herself from these people that are trying to get her. What do the police do at that particular point in time? Do they take her to the emergency room for a psychiatric evaluation? And in some cases in the past, wait up to 8 hours until they can get the evaluation done? Or do they charge her with a crime and take her to jail? Those are the choices
that they have.
Now, the problem is that if they go to the emergency room, the effort is to try to divert her from jail. But currently, one of the difficulties you've heard about so much already, and I don't need to repeat all of that, is the resources available for this woman have been diminished substantially. So the opportunities to successfully divert her from the hospital back into the community are pretty difficult. The police worry that if they do that, she's going to end up back in the same situation all over, and they're going to get called back again. Because, in fact, that's repeatedly what happens to law enforcement. So they take her to jail. The scenario continues that she ends up in jail. She's booked into the medical unit, and the first thing she does in the medical unit is strip off her clothes, roll up in a little ball, and hide in the corner. They try to get her to take medication, but she won't take the medication. She talks about being raped. She's attacked. There's been all kinds of things that have happened to her. The question now is, since she's not willing to take the medication, she obviously has got a psychiatric condition. What are the choices that they have at this particular point in time, given the limited resources that most jails have in treating people who have psychiatric problems ending up in the jail? In this particular case, they're making the decision to go to court to try to get what's called an aid and assist referral to the Oregon State Hospital. The problem is, and it's anywhere from 3 to 5 months to get into Oregon State Hospital, and they must come up with a defense attorney in order to do that, plus they must have some evaluation of her situation. At any rate, after doing that particular evaluation, she ends up getting referred to Oregon State Hospital, where she, for a variety of reasons, begins to take the medication that is appropriate for her. As a result of taking this medication, her delusions, her paranoia, her the voices in her head, the other things that are going on are no longer there. And now that she's actually somewhat stabilized, they return her back to the jail. Well, here's where the things get complicated again. She's back in the jail. She's gotten medication at Oregon State Hospital. She gets medication in the jail, because by law you have to do that. But now they're getting ready to send her out to the community, and in fact, the attorneys are working at a situation where they try to get community services for her. The problem being, there's no guarantee she can continue to get the medication when she gets out in the community. And there's not necessarily any resources out in the community that can care for them, or if they are, they're very limited. And right now, one of the issues that's difficult is funding for people who don't have any resources for care has been cut pretty substantially. Crisis services funding has been cut pretty substantially, and actually community corrections funding has been cut. So here we are with a woman who has received psychiatric treatment at Oregon State Hospital, who's been stabilized and back is in the jail. We've invested quite a bit in trying to get her to the point that her illness is no longer driving her life. We're trying to get her out in the community, and we don't have the resources in the community to sustain and support what we've now provided her in the institution. And I think that's the challenge that we all face given the situation we're in. The sad thing, and it's not just true in Oregon, but it's true across the country, is that 10 to 17% of the people in jails do have a significant mental illness. And, of course, probably in some instances 100%, but somewhere in the ballpark of 80 to 90% of those same individuals will end up having a substance abuse problem of some kind. So you've got a complicating factor not only of a mental illness, but also struggling with substance abuse problems. And I would say today that both in the situation of adults, but I would also say in the situation of juveniles, that we no longer have these nice little clean diagnostic conditions they're a little bit like the example the judge was giving about all the problems in a family. But now we have individuals that come in that may have a mental illness, may have a substance abuse problem, may have post-traumatic stress syndrome, may be involved in all kinds of domestic violence, all of those conditions in a single person. And that's much more typical of the kind of problems we deal with today. As I mentioned before, these individuals with both substance abuse and mental health problems tend to get arrested often. They tend to get into the jail. They're also more difficult to manage because they end up in the medical unit, or sometimes they end up being locked down in some particular situation. And we all know, and you've probably heard from your constituents, particularly those have family members who have a mental illness, that jails are not the really good place to recover from a mental illness, even though the staff and the others in the jail try their hardest to provide quality care for those individuals that are there. I think one of the things that's been very positive in Oregon over, I would say, the last 4 years, and I'm speaking of it from my perspective, is that we're seeing more and more communities recognize that we have to begin to deal with these two problems together, and we have to begin to find ways to deal with and reduce the number of mentally ill individuals that are going in the jail. The problem is it takes resources, and we all know those resources are currently not very available, but it still doesn't take away from the fact that we have been trying to do that, and we should continue to keep that vision out there and not lose it and try to do that in the future in whatever way we can. Because if we don't, there are going to be a larger and larger percentage of the people in the jail because the other resources won't be there. Some quick thoughts, and I'll wrap it up because I know you've heard a lot. One of the things I don't know when you begin to put all the conditions and changes and impacts that have occurred down the road together strikes me a little bit like a snowball and it's rolling down the hill and I don't quite know how big the snowball is going to get as it picks up all of the various impacts of the changes that have occurred and are going on. And that's something I don't think we know, and unfortunately it's something we'll need to focus on, and so that's what my suggestions to you to think about are related to. One is that clearly in my view, and this is my view, I think the methadone program is one of those programs that if you were to look for one thing that you ought to try to restore, that's one from a public safety standpoint that I think is really critical. The next thing I think that we need to focus about as it relates to the snowball I was talking about, and that is how do we know what that the critical indicators or the data are that tell us, folks, we've really gone too far. Now, some people might tell you that right now, and I might agree with that. But my point is, from a legislative and from a policy standpoint, what is the data? What are the indicators that you as legislators would say, you know, this tells us we've reached the bottom and we've got to change something and do that? And so I'm suggesting that there ought to be some kind of task group that begins to figure out what are those pieces of data, what are those critical indicators out there that you would use to say, we've got to significantly make a change and we've got to make it now. Lastly, what I would suggest is that in whatever decisions you make, there are going to be emergencies in this human service arena, and particularly as it relates to people going into the jail. And I would hope in your deliberations as you go through the policy thinking that you do, that you keep in mind that there needs to be some contingency to address emergencies that come up, particularly as it relates to more and more individuals ending up in the jail who have a mental illness and co-occurring disorder because other resources are drying up. With that, I will stop and entertain any questions you might have.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kummel.
Thank you. I appreciate the comments that you made with regards to restorations. And as we look at both the current biennium and the future biennium, in the current biennium, one of the mistakes that we made, particularly in the fifth special session, and I can tell you that I won't make this mistake again. I wouldn't vote for Senate Bill 5100 today if it was before me. And the reason is because we didn't put directive language into the bill with regards to the agencies. Have you made these same recommendations to the agency itself as far as restorations that can be made, could be made, or should be made to try to slow down or to try to keep the folks with mental illness from showing up in the prisons as opposed to being able to show up in some kind of a treatment plan?
Chair Winters, Chair Partridge, Representative Crummell, we've made several recommendations. In addition to the methadone program, we've made the recommendation that we clearly think that something needs to be done with regards to the medically needy. Those are very disabled folks, and the cost of medication is extremely costly for those individuals. Our estimate in terms of the health department, just for 150 of those individuals, if we were, and we can't because we don't have the money, to pick up the medication tab per month, for those individuals, it would be in the neighborhood of $50,000 to $80,000 a month. And they are very disabled folks. And the latter category that really is critical is the issue of making sure that there is an ability for them to get their medications, because in many of these brain disorders, medication is critical. And those recommendations have gone forward, yes.
Follow-up. So some of the recommendations have gone forward as far as recommendations that you've made to the agencies, to DHS, for example.
Yes, Representative.
Have some of your other recommendations basically fallen on deaf ears?
Chairs, Representative Crummell, I would say at this point in time that I'm speaking only for myself. I can't speak for my other colleagues. We're really focusing on the fact that we have contract modifications that are reducing the funding in our programs, and our effort right now is to achieve the kind of changes that we have to do to come in balance with the contracts that are being amended.
Thank you.
Senator Gordy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Davis, I want to make sure that I heard something that you said toward the end correctly. I believe you're asking this body, this panel, meaning the legislature, to think about a public policy question, and that question is, what are the indicators that we have reached the bottom with regard to how we treat the mentally ill? Is that the question? I want to make sure that I understood what you were asking of us.
Chair, Senator Gordley, yes, that is the question. It seems to me that one of the struggles we have is we have a variety of different perspectives about what that bottom is. And so you get lots of debate about, are we or are we not at the bottom? And it seems to me that's an important policy issue to really identify, in order for both the legislature, those of us that are trying to provide the services, and the community to understand what that is.
If I may, Madam Chair, what I would like to do with respect to you being the mental health professional, and others that I know who are in the room who are also mental health professionals, tell us, what is the response to that question from where you sit? We each come from our different walks of life, mm-hmm. Different life experiences, and the way that we access our understanding of this issue is maybe a little different. But you're the expert, and there are other experts in the room. Mm-hmm. Have we reached the bottom?
Chair Senator Gordley, I think that if where I'm at right now, I would say yes, we have. But what I'm trying to work with, and I'd be happy to work with my colleagues and come up with that, is not just that's my view or that's my opinion, but what are those specific indicators that would represent my opinion and would represent the opinion of my colleagues that we could share with all of you, that in fact then would give you something a little bit more objective and more specific about how to define that bottom. And I'd be happy to do that.
And that would be exactly my request, Madam Chair, if I may continue and also say that if you could provide that information in a way that reveals to us what those indicators look like for each of the 36 counties, because the story in each county is a little different.
As we, and I'm going to move us along, and I will take the questions in, Devlin, but there is an opportunity for where do we go from here. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Davis, Representative Crummell asked you about if you'd make recommendations in terms of your programs and what the impact would be on your programs by some of these cuts. Did you also make recommendations as to what efficiencies could be found within mental health programs or what alternative programs you might be willing to take less funding in order to perform these programs that you don't believe should be cut?
Chairs, Senator Devlin, the recommendations that have gone forward have been for alternative places where resources might be found in order to fund some of these programs, and also some suggestions about ways that we as local providers of service might deliver our services in a way that's different, that fits what you heard from Bob Nickel, which is evidence-based practice, and to address your other issue, might allow us to be more efficient and serve more people than otherwise we might be able to do.
Madam Chair, I appreciate that response because I guess the fundamental reality that we're dealing with is we just probably don't have enough money in the accounts to write the checks for everything that people would like to do, basically. Mm-hmm. So we've got to pick alternatives and make choices.
Mm-hmm. All right. I understand.
Thanks, Jeff. Speaking of writing checks, we'll bring up Doug Wilson now from Legislative Fiscal to help answer some of the questions that came up yesterday. Doug and his colleagues have been working overnight to be able to answer the question of what would yesterday's scenario have cost in real life. So, Doug Wilson.
Thank you, Marla, and I do not have a checkbook with me. I'm sorry. Coming around and being passed out is a memo from Robin and I briefly talking about the three general questions we're asked. I want to deal with just the first one and let you deal with the second one and third one by reading the memo. When you get the memo, if you turn the page into the third page, there's a table entitled Estimated Cost of CRIS in the Public Safety System. And after consultation with the screenwriter involved in yesterday's skit, who I'm told is lobbying the Academy for an Oscar, and after consulting them along with a number of agency folks, we came up with some real rough costs. And please keep in mind this is for informational costs. They will vary significantly depending on who the person is, the individual case, the location, because of jail costs and other costs of DAs, court practices, and a whole host of other factors. But generally, we found that these costs would be roughly about $47 million, or $47,000. Excuse me. You know, I just add zeros all the time.
I know about you, but I can get a hot flash.
Now I know what the problem with the budget is.
But one key that I want to show here is that about the first half of those items are the court-related DA costs, the investigation, the law enforcement agencies in terms of the police. They total roughly $1,500. The remainder of those costs are the incarceration costs in either the jail or the prison system or some of the treatment that might be available to them. And you'll notice that the prison cost for the 12 months that Chris served is roughly a little over half of the cost of this total $47,000. So there are some real significant costs once that person enters the system. I will also note that some of these are average costs for the state. For example, the jail costs are $79 roughly per day. That is a statewide average I got from the Department of Corrections staff who had just recently done a survey. But those vary significantly. I talked to the sheriff that was before you yesterday. He thought his costs were around $60 per day in Marion County, and they range up to probably $100 or more in the Multnomah County area. The driving factor in that is labor costs, since that is the largest factor in many of those jails. So with that, we'll be glad to answer any questions. Follow up with us after, because I know we only have a few minutes left. And a little bit left in the program.
Thank you, Doug. Thanks, Robin.
At this point, Chair Winters and members will outline a list of potential options for you. This is called the orphan list. This is a list nobody owns, nobody claims any authorship to. The list, I must tell you, is a result of a brainstorming session by the various participants in our mapping exercise. It is very important to note that some of these ideas in here are simply the result of brainstorming. They're not endorsed by any subcommittee or member of our group. We said no idea was dumb or stupid, but frankly, you'll see a couple of Lulus on this.
one moment, please.
I just want to say, for the benefit of the committees, that we don't want to belabor a lot of discussion as to whether these are good or bad policy ideas. This is just a brain. This is a brain teaser list that they're going to walk us through. I think we'd kind of prefer not to debate the merits of these, because there's some big shockers on here, and there's some hotly debated policy questions and issues. So
there are.
We're going to do a run through.
This is just to throw them out there and see what happens. We looked at these from two aspects. One was, what would reduce costs, and second was what would increase efficiencies. So those were really our two ground rules. Changing misdemeanors to violations, that one obviously saves money because there isn't any jailing of persons charged with violations. You don't have the court-appointed attorney and so forth. Eliminating the right to court-appointed counsel under the State Post-Conviction Act, or eliminating the State Post-Conviction Act altogether, obviously you save costs there. Potentially in defense costs, in prosecution costs, defendants still have the right to challenge their conviction in federal court. Reduce the mandatory minimums required in ballot measure 11. Obviously, you'd save costs there because of shorter time periods. Holding implied consent hearings in DUII cases by affidavit rather than a police officer testifying. There are about 8,000 of those hearings a year. There you save significant savings in both overtime and in travel costs. Requiring a guilty plea prior to allowing a defendant to enter into a DUII diversion program. There's actually a bill in this legislative session that would provide for that. Two that made this overhead list but not here, so some of the orphans weren't even up for adoption. So there they go. Expanding the use of video testimony in grand jury and trials, eliminating mandatory arrest by police officers in domestic violence cases, restoring outpatient mental health or chemical dependency services for about 110,000 low-income adults under the Oregon Health Plan standard, or funding those services through grants to police, services to children and families, community corrections, and crisis service. Incentives for counties and cities to operate justice and municipal courts, giving DAs discretion, greater discretion to reduce certain felonies to misdemeanors, reviewing treatment and prevention programs for their effectiveness, providing earned time credit for non-Measure 11 offenders, conducting the second look for Measure 11 juvenile offenders. There also are in your handouts and available elsewhere that further list, whether it has to do with county health courts, mental health diversion, expanding forfeiture, revising the overall sentencing structure and level of sanctions. So there's a menu of options in there, and at this point, I think it's probably, with the 20 minutes we have left, chairs all, as Judge Abernethy says, this might be the appropriate point for us to discuss with you, or you to discuss with us and the cast that's behind us, where we go from here this legislative session. It is our fondest hope that what we've done over the last couple of afternoons is show in some pretty dramatic fashion, albeit brief and abbreviated, what we know to be the interrelationships and the interdependencies of so many of the participants and the players in the public safety system, not limited to criminal justice, not limited to law enforcement, courts, mental health, but all of us together.
Marla, as the traffic controller, the one who has made this fly, I want to personally thank you and thank all the players. And then I'm going to to yield to Representative Williams as the chair to have his comments on where do we go from here.
Thank you very much, Chair Winters. And I also want to thank Marla and the staff of the committees who went through a lot of work even before the legislative session began, putting this overview for all of us and all our committees together. I appreciate the work that they've done. I think it is probably the first time in most people's memory when we've had all these committees meeting concurrently to get this broad picture of how all of these functions interrelate. And if I had one message for my fellow colleagues, both in the House and the Senate, it is as we deal with the difficult issues that are upon us in the next 4 or 5 months as these budgets start to work their way through the system, that we do remember the balance necessary in each of these components. None of these components can operate separately or independently without being balanced against the other, be it the courts, be it the indigent defense side, be it the district attorney side, be it the prevention and drug and alcohol treatment side. However we want to approach it, we have to maintain that balanced system approach. I also would say that I think the time is upon us, and we've heard it mentioned by several presenters, talking about essentially approaching this from an evidence-based approach. And I asked Council Taylor to drop off on the desk. Each of you have a list that is labeled evaluating programs, things to look for, and it goes down a list of A through Y, the kinds of things that you ought to look for in evaluating program. And I think it's incumbent upon us, both at the policy committee level that I operate on and at the budgetary level that both the Chair Winters and Chair Patridge operate on, to ensure that we are using the best method we can to evaluate programs and to not we really are faced with a situation where we have to make the decision, are we going to simply continue to thin the soup, which is essentially the approach that we have taken thus far in the cuts that we have made, or is it time to start culling the herd and deciding what does work, what doesn't work, and not assume that everything we've been doing is necessarily the right way to do it, and maybe there are some things we ought to be doing differently. And I think we frankly have to roll up our sleeves, and I don't mean that frankly in reference to you, Senator Morris, I do think that we have to roll up our sleeves and start evaluating these programs, and we need to use the evidence-based approach. We need to justify the money that we're spending with demonstrable effects to the best that we can, evaluate the cost effectiveness, avoid replication, look at long-term evaluations, spend a little money to ensure that we track the numbers so we have the long-term evaluations. One of our biggest challenges in this process is having longitudinal data that tells us whether or not we're spending money on anything that works and that matters. And so a legislator gets a great idea, it sounds great, it sells great, but we don't do anything to follow it or track it. And 15 years later, it's a line item in the budget, and we've got no idea whether or not it's actually producing the results that we all hoped it would produce when we voted for it. So one of the things we ought to do is we ought to start implementing those kinds of longitudinal tracking. And if it costs us 0.1% of the budget of a program to institute measurable effects and the data gathering necessary for measurable effects, it will be well worth the price 15 or 20 years from now as people who sit in these chairs are facing the very same kinds of problems that we're facing today. So with that in mind, I think that many of the things up on the, I noticed cringes as we looked at that list and some of those things up there. I think there are some that I think all of us could agree we're probably not going to have any conversation about in this legislative session. I think there are other things up there and a whole host of other ideas that we need to be willing to entertain as we try to address the long-term needs of the public safety system. So I guess I'll use those general comments as my view of where we go from here. How we do it is much more challenging. I mean, they sort of had this interesting little approach. Who they are, what they do, what are the effects? Well, who are we? We're the legislature. What do? We try to figure this out, and what are the effects? It matters to everybody. How we actually sit down around a table with all of the interested parties and all of us as members of these various committees and figure out how we're going to fix the mental health system so it's not so fragmented, how we're going to direct dollars back into drug and alcohol treatment to programs that make a difference, is going to require a lot of effort, and it's going to be incumbent on us as members and on the staff of our committees, I think, to set up the system that we're going to use this session to try to address these issues. So with that, I'll turn it over to Representative Patridge for his remarks.
Thanks, Max. I, too, would like to thank the staff and especially Representative Williams for really kicking this off prior to the legislative session and including Chair Winters and I at our committees in the mix. I certainly appreciate that. And, Marla, thank you thank you for being the ringleader in terms of making this happen. I appreciate everyone's participation, and for someone who's served the last, this will be my third session in the budget committees, I appreciate the holistic approach that was offered as to the effects on the entire criminal justice system. Coming from my perspective, directly from a district attorney's office as a deputy DA into the legislature, I had a little more insight than some of the rest of my colleagues that sit here in terms of the effects and how the system internally works. And I appreciate that, and also maybe took that a little for granted when people ask questions. I know the presentations over the last 2 days have had a effect on members of my committee because they've talked to me about it. They have a better understanding and a clarity of really how the system does work holistically. So I appreciate that. But I also think it's important that we also challenge the criminal justice community as well. We've taken the first step. We've had the hearings. We've attempted to educate the legislature. It's incumbent upon us to act, but it is also incumbent upon the criminal justice community, which tends to have many silos and individual departments who fight against each other, to come to us with holistic approaches. Unfortunately, in our criminal justice community, we have a lot of people who fight with each other, as I just said, and they don't work together as well as maybe Doug Harkleroad and his colleague there in Lane County. We don't have that kind of cooperation where people step up hand in hand. I understand that programs are important and you all individually advocate for your people and your program. I also know that, and I also know and appreciate that you all understand the system holistically. But by the same time, you do need to get together. You do need to do some of the things in terms of looking at the approaches to how we deal with the problems, whether it be treatment, whether it be incarceration, in the system as a whole. But I also agree with Max that we do need measurable data. And I've worked very hard the last two sessions to try and make part of that happen and to have outcomes that are measurable so we can actually track people and make a difference, and have met with a great deal of resistance from the law enforcement community in terms of trying to get those things together. Work with the legislature to come up with creative solutions and think outside of the box so that you will have measurable outcomes. So I would just encourage the law enforcement community to also gather together and provide some leadership. The public safety coordinating councils in each of our counties across the state can make a difference, but they need to come forward with recommendations on how we can best serve. Judge Abernathy and several of her colleagues on the bench have done some of those things through the family courts, where they've been able to gather some of the groups and resources together in order to deal with the situation holistically. Those are things that need to be duplicated, I believe, across the state and need to make a difference. So I would encourage the law enforcement community and the public safety community as well as DHS to come together with those creative solutions to the legislature and maybe look at funding those things instead of in Representative Winter's committee and in my committee and each committee individually to maybe offer up some packages as we move forward. I know it's difficult to do this session, but in the future I'd hope that we're making a first step forward.
Thank you. Since I have a human services budget, let me talk a little about not only just the presentation, the holistic approach, but we're facing tremendous challenges, and I think all of us recognize that. Senator Gordley made a comment in talking to Jeff Davis, and I want to put it back out there. We're all in this boat. And, when we talk holistic approach, we need your input and your some of your alternatives as well. You know, so often there's been a disconnect between you coming and asking us for money, but not coming and talk to us about solutions and how we can do things better. This session is going to be devoted more to how can we do things better within the resources that we have. With that in mind, we have structured some committees, and to try to address some of that. The Oregon Health Plan, for example, that's been mentioned a lot here and its impact and implications. There will be a work group, a task force that's being put together as I speak that will be devoted to looking at the Oregon Health Plan and some of the issues that have been raised here and have been raised from the community to see how we can do and deal with that better. We also are putting together a task force to deal with mental health issues. Senator Gordley will be one member on that task force, and then there will be Representative Bates is also a member on that. They will be asking for your input. They will be asking for you not to talk about your problems. I think we all know problems. They will be talking to you about, you know, some ideas for solutions. How can we structure systems better? How can we do it in a way that we're not having to look in the paper and talk about thousands of our most vulnerable citizens not getting taken care of? And I think that's all of our mission. So often, I think we've gone through the booms of the 90s and we've forgotten about, you know, actually service delivery systems and their effectiveness. And I think now the onus is on all of us to talk about the effectiveness, and that gets back to what both Representative Patrick and Williams have said. Last session, a number of us, started the debate about outcomes. We started putting budget notes on agency budgets and saying, come back to us next session and tell us what the results are. Come back and tell us what works. Come back and talk about evidence-based and what's there. Anecdotal information now will not drive these budgets. And I think as you are about doing your jobs out there, you know better than we do what is needed and why it is needed. You also know where you can tinker with the system to make it better. And I think, we're willing to listen to you. We're asking for your input. We're asking for you to be a partner with us as we craft these budgets and as we craft policy.
If I could, I'd just say that I think that I'm hoping that you see and are seeing a new era of approaching this system with this meeting over the last 2 days. I intend to work very closely from a policy side with Representative Patridge and with Representative Winters, and I hope they will work with me, and they have committed to work with me on a budget side as we work through these issues in a more holistic approach. I hope the day will come when we will actually break the system we have now of only having the ways and means people hunkered down in the basement and the policy people up on the third floor, and we actually have some crossover and committee assignments. But barring
kind of like meeting in this room, didn't
you? Yeah, barring that happening in this session, this approach and this kind of approach where we're going to work together as a team in trying to address these issues is, I believe, the first step to moving that direction. So it is our intent to try to do that. And that means that y'all have to be speaking the same message in front of the same committee, and that means that we're going to be applying the same set of standards in my committee that we're applying down in the Ways and Means Committee on evaluating programs and statutory changes and approaches, because the only way we're going to solve this is if we all work together. And I want to thank particularly all of you who I know aren't in this room unless you had some part to play in trying to make this presentation work, whether you were actually a presenter or one of the people behind the scenes providing so much of the information that went into the various people who did represent large swaths of the state system as they were making those presentations. And I think the committee members, one and all, thank you for your efforts and time as well. Chair Winters.
Thank you. And if there's no other comments from...
Bill, you were listed as the moderator. Do you have anything you want to say?
He did a great job.
You've done an excellent job so far, Bill.
I do have something to say. About 25 years ago, I went before a judge with a motion, and I was supposed to say something. He read my brief and turned to the other party and said, what do you have to say to this? Why can't you do it? I started to speak up, and he said, quit when you're ahead. I'm quitting when I'm ahead.
And with that, we are adjourned.
You guys, that would have been a...